And we continue today with our series on speakers from the Kivira Coalition Conference. I'm very happy now to welcome Dorn Cox. He's a farmer in New Hampshire. He's co-founder of FarmHack, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here.
So you grew up on an organic farm in New Hampshire. Your parents were back to the land people from the 1970s. Then you went to college with no, as I understand it, real intention of returning to the farm. You went into high finance. You went into high tech. You lived all over the world. Why did you go back to the farm?
Well, I did. I studied international ag and rural development in my undergrad. And after traveling all over the world, realized that we had an extraordinary opportunity to make a large difference right there at home. And if that we, with all the resources we had in New Hampshire, if we couldn't figure it out with institutions of higher learning, with incredible network access and connections to people, very dense, influential area of the world, if we couldn't figure it out there and make a difference, then I don't know how we could.
Not to mention quite a lot of farmland.
Well, that, yeah, it's fascinating. In New Hampshire, we're only farming a tiny fraction of the available soils, less than 10% of that. And in fact, it's as a state, we lost. We were essentially 80% farmed, and now we're 80% forested.
Mm.
In the 1830s, there were more sheep in two towns in New Hampshire than there are in all of New England today. Just to give a sense. So we have actually very productive soils. We've got 40 inches of rain a year, and we've got a local market right there. And that's what we've tapped into and begun to explore with. But it's a different model of production than has been conventionally promoted.
Well, this is one of the things that's so interesting, because there's a kind of very important philosophical aspect to it, which is, as I understand it, your view of the land is that rather than exploiting it or extracting from it as mining industries do and as commercial agriculture does, you can think of the land as a living regenerative system, as a source of wealth, something that you're building up rather than extracting from, which is a kind of thinking put forward in the 18th century. You talk about a movement called physiocracy. Tell us about that, how that changed during the Industrial Revolution, and then how that kind of thinking is influencing what you do.
Sure, that's exactly right. So the physiocrats were land-based economists that started in the mid-1700s, part of the Enlightenment movement, and their central tenet was that a nation's wealth was built on the health of the soil, and in order to increase the wealth of a nation, you had to increase the productivity of the soil. That anything else was exactly what you're talking about, extractive. It was derivative. It was just a transformation of that original wealth. And so if you think about that, the limiting factor in a natural system is not carbon or nitrogen or phosphorus. It's really the knowledge and managing the complexity. So rather than thinking about it as opposed to an input system where you're saying we have limited resources and we are going to protect them, if you're thinking about managing a complex system, it's the limiting factor is knowledge.
Right.
And so in order to increase our ability to manage a regenerative system is how do we increase the amount of knowledge in the population to manage that?
And so you brought a lot of knowledge in, both from your childhood on the farm and then from your work in high tech and high finance and systems analysis. Because, I mean, it's one thing to plant a row of corn, it's another thing to see a farm as a complex system with all these different agents interacting with one another.
Right, exactly. Well, and where we're at a unique point in history is that we've in the last couple decades enabled our computational power. Essentially, this accumulate. In the 1750s, what they had were printed words. You could accumulate knowledge at the pace in which you could write them and print them. But as we invented the internet, which is only 5,000 days old, we enabled a dramatic acceleration of exchange of knowledge. And so when I'm looking at what the next stage is to be able to manage this complexity, it's harnessing that collective knowledge, not just accumulated knowledge, but starting to be able to use the computational power associated with that to really manage some of that complexity. So when we're talking about, a lot of what we talk about in conventional ag and precision ag is how precise can we, how homogeneous can we make that system? But that's still a simplistic approach, is saying how simple can we make agriculture? And what I see the potential is to harness that computational power and say, how complex can we manage it?
Now, what does that actually look like? Give us some examples.
Yeah, so a lot of what we're trying to do on our farm is mix multiple systems together. So that's animal and plant and different types of diversity of animals and plants. So on our operation, we have I do a lot with grains, oilseed, livestock, a lot of cover crops. I've raised about a dozen different types of grains. But in that rotation are also the different animal rotations, as well as vegetable operations, forestry. We're also mixing the forestry operation and the nutrient flows from our fields through the forests. So starting to graze in the understory during certain periods and looking at trying to really fill the niches, if it's an ecological concept. So if you think part of what the there's this in the no-till movement they talk about, you want the something growing as much of the year as possible. But not just growing, we're looking at filling all those niches within the growth, both above the ground as well as below the ground. So if you think about plant structures, some of them grow vertically, some of them grow horizontally, some of them spread along the ground. Well, each of those are different niches, and so the goal is to fill those niches and structures, and the same with the roots. Some are pushing straight down, some are going horizontal, and when they're not occupying the same space, they're not competing directly, they're actually complementing. And that's also true that some plants have different strategies. So annuals are going to grow really quickly and try to, and that's their strategy during a very short period of time in the year, whereas perennials are going to have a different a strategy of storing energy for the next year. And you also have other plants that are warm season plants that are trying to grow late in the summer really rapidly, and you have cool season that are growing earlier. And that so we're mixing structures as well as mixing and matching plants that fill in those niches. So not only do you have growth around the year, but you have sort of maximum growth as much as possible.
And some of these plants you harvest and sell, and same with the animals.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the and part of this complexity is also managing this diversity of products and then bringing those to market. So the other part of physiocracy is that it views it in the context of an agrarian culture, so that it's not the farmer as part of industry, as a business. It's in fact that they use imagine the economy like a tree. So agriculture at the roots, with a population at the trunk, and arts and commerce are a byproduct of that. And if you think about what that means from a resilience perspective, the leaves and branches can be damaged in a storm, but if the roots were damaged, the whole tree can wither and die. And and so it's a concept about resilience. But the more important thing when we talk about marketing and the product is that everybody has an interest in improving the quality of the soil, and in encouraging agriculture to be resilient. So that's part of our farm's operation also, is engaging the public in that operation and its success, and managing that complexity of a diversity of products and having that the values that are associated with that also be part of those products. So we're working with a CSA model, but also with restaurants and wholesalers. But I think part of the value is engaging the people in the process.
Now, when you talk about this incredibly, I mean, to me, mind-bogglingly complex system of the relatively small farm, several hundred acres that you are farming, it takes a kind of, as you say, knowledge is the thing. It takes a kind of knowledge and ability to sort of hold this all together. I mean, you're doing this, you, Doran Cox, but you're also involved in a network of people through this, what do you call it, this phenomenon called FarmHack, which is this open source movement.
Right, exactly. This is, and that's in fact part of the reason that I'm so excited about FarmHack and got involved and put so much effort, personal effort into it, because these are too complex. These systems are too complex for any individual farm to figure out, too complex for any individual academic to map, to hold it all. So it really requires sharing the risk of experimentation and building this cumulative knowledge base about how it all works, because I believe that where we're at is that it gets really complex while we're figuring that out until these systems stabilize, and then it becomes much more simple.
Has that happened yet?
We're seeing elements of that as we're starting to see as the soil systems start to function and get healthier, the involvement and the labor involved goes down. We're transferring this model where it's intensive work and we're having to provide all the inputs to creating a system that is not entirely self-sustaining. This is part of where we're managing it and tweaking it, but we're managing a system that is feeding essentially on itself.
Now, the point of making your life so complicated and having so many different plants and animals and annuals and perennials and forests and all of the things that you're talking about is to build a truly regenerative system that you're not exploiting. And the bottom line currency, so to speak, with that is carbon.
Yeah, carbon is an indicator of the one indicator of the health of the system. It's very difficult to build carbon if it's like a bank, right? And so what we're looking at is accumulating enough in that deposit that we're living off the interest essentially. But that
Right.
carbon is constantly cycling and active. So, but absolutely, carbon is a really good indicator of the health of the system.
Let's talk for a moment about FarmHack. I mean, you have talked about the fact that collaboration among all the different people who are involved, and it's a lot of people at this point, I think, who are involved, builds resilience, perhaps in the same way that biodiversity builds resilience. What are some of the things that you're actually doing? Like, how are you sharing information?
Yeah, well, I think that diversity of people and ideas is really important. So when we founded FarmHack, we explicitly were going not just to farmers, but to the wider population and all the rest of the skills. So that's roboticists and designers and web developers and landscape architects, and bringing that diversity of skill, those diversity of skills together for problem solving. It's a plat FarmHack at its essence is about collaborative problem solving.
What are some of the problems that you're solving
So,
together?
one of the very early projects was an environmental monitoring problem, a greenhouse overheating, and in an especially, an unexpected day, or and that also solves some of the. And that's that same issue is it gets too cold. It's that plants in controlled environment need a certain climate to survive, and so the farmer brought the question to the FarmHack community and said, "Well, what can this group do?" And so very quickly they said, "Well, we could put together a pretty quick text messaging alert system with open source hardware that we're familiar with." And so that was that. The prototype was built. It got implemented, and very quickly evolved to say, "Wait a minute. This same system could not just text message. We could connect this to the internet, and it could log your temperature for the entire year. You could get some more knowledge from that." And because the designs were published, it quickly adapted also to a system that could be used to monitor electric fences and water levels and then soil moisture. And then, wait a minute, now we can actually look, if we tie that to our weather, we can say, what is the water capacity of this soil? Because we know how much it rained, and we know how wet it is, and we know how quickly it dried out. So it quickly feeds on it, and I think that's a really important element of the collaborative research and development, is that the ultimate use is not necessarily tied to the original development, and that you're putting that out so that it can quickly cross-pollinate with other ideas and expand without the burdens of patents and so forth. And that's one of our biggest jobs with FarmHack, is to protect that process and make sure that the ideas are free to cross-pollinate.
And what's so interesting is, I mean, like in the example you just gave, what starts with monitoring the temperature of a greenhouse ends up being not only, oh, my greenhouse is getting hot, I'll take action, but it's a whole R&D. So this is data that gets collected that then can lead to much bigger knowledge sets that can in turn be used by all kinds of farmers.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, and I really see that there are two types of technologies that we're developing with FarmHack. One are the tools that we're using to act on the land. So, for example, a roller crimper that we use to crimp cover crops was developed and made open source by Rodale Institute. And that's been had lots of iterations to improve it for different landscapes and uses. But those tools are really a reflection of our understanding of the systems that we're working in. And so the other category is observational technology. So things like data logging and measuring temperature and soil moisture and weather, that informs our understanding of how these systems work, which can then feed back into better tools.
Now, this sounds like, if I may say so, kind of a young person's model. Is this a kind of like the new generation of farmers that's involved with this?
Well, it's I think a young person's model as far as our familiarity with the technology that's evolving so quickly, but a lot of what we've been doing is documenting a lot of the technology that's already been developed. So it's very much an interface with all of the history of technology and agricultural knowledge. So one of the first projects that we did was digitize the practical Encyclopedia of Practical Farm Knowledge from 1918, distributed by the Sears and Roebuck Foundation. Incredible volumes of detailed, crowdsourced technical knowledge associated with agriculture. And even that is being built on this history of physiocracy and the creation of the original crowdsourced encyclopedia in 1751, with thousands of authors trying to catalog not just science and arts, but paid particular attention to the details of farming and metallurgy and the skills associated with that really drove the system. They call them the mechanical arts. And so that was really important. So I say it's, and I say that as far as young person and old person, but I think this young person's what we have access to now, partly because of the internet and accessibility of these documents, which are now being able to be crowdsourced, it's expanding who we can talk to, both in our current generation, but also making inaccessible documents and documentation accessible.
I mean, there's such a huge philosophical piece of this that I find really exciting, which is that what is knowledge when it goes into a library? If nobody ever opens that book again, does it still exist in some way? And then when you bring it into a conversation, then that knowledge lives again. It's almost like, to me, the knowledge in those archives is like seeds, and then when you bring them into the conversation, they
Yep.
become plants.
What a wonderful way of saying it. That's exact. Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. And so we've historically, partly because of the a lot of it has been archived and it's in the printed form, and that's great. It's there, but it's like a seed bank. You're absolutely right. And so we've been stuck with a model of academics who live close to it, who can go in and spend ages flipping through old documents. But part of what we're finally able to do with digitization is actually do active searches. So if you're curious, you can actually, and that's how I've found a lot of this, is because a lot of it has been digitized. And in fact, I had this French encyclopedia passages on my I can pick it up on my iPhone and just get the part that I'm interested in.
Now, has any of that really centuries-old technology been of use to you or other farmers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of the patents, we've found designs for patented, say, an oat dehuller that we documented on FarmHack. It was out of patent, no longer manufactured, but we had documentation, and so it's been built into a prototype. And now those plans, those hand-drawn engineering drawings, are now in digital format, in 3D, that can be sent and to any manufacturer anywhere to replicate.
And is now being used?
And it's now published on FarmHack.
We're talking to Dorn Cox. Now, you've got all this open source, you've got all this sharing, people are sharing knowledge rather than patenting it. What is the business model? I mean, everybody has their land and what they farm on it, they sell.
Yeah, so the basic difference is shifting from profit from production rather than protection. And now, most businesses have an element of both. This is just emphasizing the production rather than the protection side of it. And that the protection, and in fact, what we're doing is focusing on innovation as being sort of the competitive advantage and skills and how you actually use the information that you have rather than trying to hoard it and extract. It's another form of extraction, but just in the form of knowledge. And so one of the next stages with FarmHack is to add a commerce section to it so that the folks who are producing kits and products are able to then connect with other folks, or if you have skills so that you're trading on skills again and production rather than just this element of protection. But it means that local manufacturers have this vast array of knowledge that they can draw upon. So if a farmer comes in and says, well, this is the tool I want, well, here are all the templates that you can just pull down. You have a design, a library, essentially, of which to use. And so the idea is that every farm then becomes sort of a research farm feeding into that library, and then every neighbor can be your manufacturer. And that's happening with the maker movement too, with these maker spaces and precision machining that makes this more possible, 3D printers that make this more possible.
Right. Now, has this, FarmHack, you're very close to Boston and MIT and to a community of people who think in that way. Has it spread into other parts of the country? Are other farmers using this as well?
Yeah, it's very interesting to look at the use patterns. It's absolutely true that we started in the MIT. In fact, the first event was at MIT, but it very quickly spread around New England and then to the coasts and then to the upper Midwest. And it's if you look at the internet use or the internet connectivity, it seems to be spreading roughly along internet connectivity sort of centers. Likewise, in Europe, we've had a lot of contributors from Germany and France and England, but it pretty much follows that. But as we have more connectivity, I think we're going to see that contributions also get more diverse. But we've had contributions from every continent except for Antarctica.
Now, there is something about this, and I notice it every time I come to these Kivira Coalition events, these conferences, is that there's so much excitement about solutions and about positive ways of thinking. We've all been kind of like turned toward depression and despair by the specter of climate change and the seeming inexorable doom that it is bringing. You guys are doing something that is absolutely anti-climate change in the sense that the type of farming you're doing is sequestering carbon and not using carbon. The idea is to have a positive output. You put out more than, how does that work?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Where if you shift from this this extractive model, which is sort of protect, and you view these resources as being a limited resource, then you derive profit from sort of limiting access to it and doling it out. Whereas if you see that as a productive resource, then and you're living off its function, then the whole equation of how the economies flow and how you treat information and how you view working with that land changes.
And also, when you talk about inputs and outputs, I mean, the energy going into the system in terms of maybe diesel or petroleum inputs, I know you're doing you're growing oil seeds for oil, biodiesel, but there's still some diesel, but the energy in is less than the energy output of the system.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the most fundamental pieces of the equation. And that's what's, you know, created a livable climate on Earth in the first place. And so this is just tapping into that and then changing the economy to be based on how successful are we in creating a productive system that we can live on that surplus and invest a part of that surplus back into the soil to improve that each cycle.
And absorb the world's CO2 in the process.
Exactly. So that's one of the things that I often see. We talk about atmospheric CO2 as a problem, but we haven't been talking so much about the deficiency of carbon in the soils, and that's actually something we can do about. And that's the difference, I think, when we talk about the hacker versus consumer mentality, is the consumer mentality is a little bit helpless in that scenario. You're saying, what can we do? We can reduce our carbon footprint. That's still assuming that you have a carbon footprint instead of this notion that you can actually be active in the process. And it's not, you know, this idea of peak oil and so forth is still a consumer approach, as opposed to saying, we're not stuck in that system. We actually can take action individually, and we're producers ourselves. So we're not dependent on somebody to solve this project, this something that we can buy. The idea is that we're active in it, and we can say these tools that we have, not products, these tools are projects. They're the beginning that we can mix and shape and adapt to our own use to solve this problem.
There's also something that's really compelling about being able to contribute to something positive as opposed to mitigating something negative. And you had a kind of amusing example that had to do with nitrogen going into the water supply in a college town.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly. I mean, this is part of where we talk about observational technology, right? And where when we start to apply these tools to our environment, we get a new sense of understanding. And so this example was, you know, our farm is on the Great Bay Watershed, which is the largest estuary north of the Chesapeake. And we have a nitrogen problem, partly from agriculture, but also from a lot of development. And so we're faced right now with extraordinary hundreds of millions of dollars of cost borne by the towns to start to extract that nitrogen. Interestingly, just to give us a sense, it costs these wastewater treatment plants $100 a pound to extract nitrogen. They're looking
wow.
Right. Yeah. And for what? It's all energy input. And yet this is a valuable resource. They're also looking at natural systems like oyster beds to extract it as the lowest cost way, until we started to say, well, if we land apply it, that may be the lowest cost, and we look at soil health systems. But the monitoring, part of this process started monitoring. We have new tools to monitor at higher resolution. So they started, instead of monitoring once a week, started monitoring once a day, and they realized in our town's wastewater treatment plant that nitrogen was spiking 30% on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And that was the difference between them being able to keep up and not keeping up with the nitrogen load.
And why was it spiking on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday?
Well, you can imagine a college town on Thursday and Friday nights, what happens.
So what were, ladies and gentlemen, people were drinking beer and urinating nitrogen.
Precisely. And so, and it gets funnier than that is that once they started surveying the college kids, that only 50% of it was actually getting into the septic system. But that's another topic.
Yes.
So with this data, we could start to tell a story instead of saying, well, we just have this amount of nitrogen. Well, actually, we have a story associated with that and how it happened. And then we can go out. And so a group of students went and said, well, let's try and educate folks about why this is happening. And so they got a P bus and said, help save the bay. And they didn't get a lot of good response. But then they started talking about how your urine is fertilizer. They got a great response and had lines in the P bus to start collecting it. And it wasn't enough to shift this balance, but it was the beginning of a conversation that can start to shift our cultural understanding of how nutrients cycle through the landscape. And then this link between nutrients in the town and getting them back to the farm where they can be productively applied. And it turns out, nitrogen isn't in is very well in urine in general is a very readily available nutrients in potassium and phosphorus and nitrogen.
And I mean, one of the take homes from that is that people respond more to give me your fertilizer than save the bay.
Absolutely. It's this positive message again,
Yeah.
is figuring that out. And some of that comes from this greater systems understanding, but also engaging more people in the process.
Now, what is your vision for the state of New Hampshire?
Oh, yeah, great question. We have it's actually we're working on that's it's a it is actually a great question. We're working with a group called Food Solutions New England, actually, to develop each of the New England states' vision for the future. And so there's a right now the visioning committee has something they call 50 by 50, which is 50% food sufficiency by 2050. And that rolls out a very diverse set of objectives, which include social justice issues and land use patterns. Because we've seen a consolidation of land, even in New Hampshire. We're only producing about 5% of our land right now. And the farmer population isn't representative of the population at large. And so we think that that's also part of getting more people involved in agriculture and seeing themselves as being part of that process.
Dorn Cox is a farmer in New Hampshire. He's co-founder of Farm Hack, which can be found at farmhack.net. If people who are listening are farmers or are interested in this, or maybe manufacturers and want to get involved, how do they do so? I mean, we're here in New Mexico right now.
Sure. Well, set up an account on FarmHack and post. You can. I'm posting fairly often. You can also find me at greenstartnh.org.
greenstartnh.org. Dorn Cox, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.